Probably don't really need to explain to everyone in here why we're interested in pursuing bioenergy. Obviously, implications for climate change, or as Thomas Friedman called it, global weirding, fuel prices and rising fuel demands. As we saw in the Gulf this year, it's getting harder and harder to extract the fossil fuels that we have left. Bioenergy is, of course, renewable, and because it's locally produced, it is expected to be a catalyst to revitalize local and rural economies. So where are we going to get all this biomass from? We've heard a lot of talks this week about crop residues, things like corn stover, but of course only some of that can be removed. In South Georgia, we've got a lot of things like peanut hulls that can be burned for heat and power, and sugarcane mills have been burning their bagasse for heat and power. There's things like annual energy crops. We just heard about sorghums. Things like sun hemp, which is a legume, also produce a lot of biomass. We also heard some good talks this week about woody species, fast-growing trees like pine, poplar, and eucalyptus. And what I'm going to talk about is perennial grasses. Some of the candidate crops are switchgrass, giant reed, giant miscanthus. And in South Georgia, we can grow something called Napier grass, but that's a future talk. I'm going to talk today about energy canes. These are F1 or Backcross 1, basically early generation hybrids between cultivated sugar canes and their related wild relatives. They're vegetatively propagated, just like sugarcane. They're perennial, but they have better cold tolerance than typical sugarcane, so they can be grown further north. They have higher fiber content and better ratooning ability, which means they can be cut more often than sugar canes. And there's basically two types. In addition to standard sugar cane, there's type 1 energy canes, which are grown for both the sugar and the lignocellulose, and then type 2s are primarily grown as a fiber crop. Our design, we had two cold-tolerant sugarcane cultivars. We had one type 1 energy cane, and the rest were type 2s. This was located in Tifton, Georgia. If you've never been there, it's right here in the coastal plain region of Georgia. And in the first growing season, we took sequential harvests around the first week of the month, October through February. We didn't get sequential harvest in 09, but we're going to repeat this this fall. We did get total biomass and Brix readings in both years, though. This is our harvest equipment. We do get some interesting looks from passing cars on this thing, but there's a scale unit here in the back. We can measure all the biomass and logs it right into a computer. The first bar is the 08 harvest, the second bar is the 09 harvest. You can see the type 2 canes, as expected, had very good yields. The sugar cane cultivars were the lowest in yield. The type 1 cane was kind of intermediate, more like the sugar canes. But pay attention to this blue one here, this HO0107. This one, as I was looking through the data this week, I noticed it was kind of interesting. This is classified as a type 2 cane, however. We noticed it had a pretty good sugar content. This is Brix, which is we go into the plot and take a couple of billets and squeeze the juice out and read the sugar content in a refractometer. The sugarcane cultivars, they peaked around the time of first frost. When sugarcane gets stressed out, it makes more sugar. So in both years, the sugar canes peaked around 20% sugar in the sap, and there was some variation between the type 2s and the type 1. Our moisture content, which is very important for harvesting logistics, wet biomass is heavy, it's expensive to transport. We noticed the high sugar types, the type 1, this one here that was listed as a type 2, seems to be behaving as a type 1, and the sugar canes tended to retain moisture even on into February, whereas finally late in the season, the type 2 canes begin to finally decline in moisture. We looked at nitrogen content to see if that decreased throughout the season. We know with things like switchgrass that and the finer stem grasses that nitrogen does decrease throughout the winter. During senescence, October through November, we did see a significant decrease in nitrogen, but then throughout the winter, it basically leveled off. And we only saw moderate differences between the various entries in terms of nitrogen content. We also looked at ash content. And this one, we really didn't see much change over harvest dates. The big difference here is that the different genotypes gave us a wide variation in, in ash content. And of course, this is very important for if we were going to use this for combustion purposes. So the sugary types tended to be on the lower end as far as ash content, and the higher fiber types were up here in the higher end. We also looked at fiber composition using filter bag methods, neutral detergent fiber, acid detergent fiber, and acid detergent lignin. Again, harvest date really didn't have much of an effect on the fiber qualities. What that says is that the stuff is not degrading in the field as it stands there. That indicates maybe there's a wider harvest window for these things. They're not going to degrade. These are ranked here in order that they were of yield. So the type 2 canes, as expected, have a lot more fiber content than the sugar cane here. This is the type 1 cane, and this is the one that in Louisiana seems to behave more as a type 2 cane, but at our location in Tifton, it has a lot more sugar and a lot less fiber. And as I mentioned, sugarcane, when it gets stressed, tends to produce more sugar. So this one, in our location, something appears to be causing it to have a stress response and behave more like a type 1 energy cane. All the fiber components were correlated, so the ones that tend to be higher in lignin also had higher hemicellulose and higher cellulose content. Basically, anything up to 100% on this graph would be mostly free sugars. So our next step, and we've just started this, is to look at the actual ethanol yields that we can get out of these energy cane biomass. So we're using right now just a bench top scale, partial sacrification, and co-fermentation experiment. And we start with a 10% solids, just biomass, finely ground biomass and water, and we autoclave that just to sterilize it. Let that cool, and then we add Novo 13 and Novo 188 enzymes. The optimal pH for these enzymes is lower than the optimal pH for our organism that's fermenting it. And the optimal temperature for the enzymes is a bit higher as well. So we let the enzymes do their thing for 24 hours without adding our organisms. So that's why this is a partial saccharification. After 24 hours, we take a sample, measure the sugar content. Then we add our E. coli. We're using a bioengineered E. coli that's able to ferment both 5 and 6 carbon sugars. Has a chloramphenicol resistance gene in it. We drop the temperature down to 37 and bump the pH up to 5.5. This is kind of a compromise here so that the enzyme can continue to work, albeit at a lower rate, but the E. coli can start to ferment out the sugars that are being released. These are preliminary results. We've only run the first few sets of these from the October. But what we found was that one of these sugar canes had, obviously we're starting out with a lot of sugar, because this is whole biomass. We didn't press any of the sugar out. But we do see some sugar release after 24 hours on most of these. And then after we add the organism, the E. coli, we see that the sugar content starts going down. Except that this one appears that there's something maybe some inhibitors or something possibly present in this one. And then the bottom graph shows ethanol production. So at zero is when we add the E. coli. The control is just, there's no biomass in that one. That's just the organism by itself. And you can see we got a really wide variation in the amount of ethanol per gram of biomass that we're getting from these things. And surprisingly, the highest one of these was the our type 2 energy cane that at our location was behaving more like a type 1, followed by the actual sugar canes and then the type 2s. There wasn't any pre-treatment in this. This is just to give us a baseline. Our next step would also be to look at different pre-treatments to see if we can squeeze more free sugars out of these things. So in conclusion, we did see that the bricks, the sugar content, did vary by date, and first frost was about when it would peak. We would expect that. That's when the plant begins to get stressed and starts senescing. Moisture content did not significantly change until late in the winter, and then really only for the type 2 canes. Finally, by February, it started to decline significantly. The high sugar types tended to retain moisture. These are tend to be thicker stemmed, more like what you would think of as a sugar cane. Nitrogen content did decrease early in the fall when the plant was senescing, but then after the frost had hit and the plant is pretty much dead, the nitrogen content in the biomass doesn't really seem to go down after that. We did find a lot of variation in ash and fiber content, although the various components of the fiber tended to be correlated. Our partial saccharification co-fermentation experiment, we've seen some significant variation in ethanol yield, so we're kind of excited to keep going with it, with this experiment and see what kind of results we get after we've repeated it a few more times. So I just want to acknowledge our technicians at the ARS location. GIFT, this is a Georgia Intern Fellowships for Teachers. We actually had a sixth grade teacher intern with us for a month this summer. She got a crash course in biofuels, so she got to take those experiences back to the classroom and hopefully get her students fired up about bioenergy. And then our collaborators at the UGA Tifton campus. So with that, I thank you, and I'll take some questions.
We have time for a few questions.
Yep.
Actually, a couple of points. First, bricks is not sugar.
Right. It also includes any soluble starches and things. Right. It's mostly sugar. Right.
The second thing is that stressed sugar cane does not produce sugar. Stress does not make sugar cane make sugar. It causes a change in growth to storage. So it just is repartitioning.
It's repartitioning. Right. It's repartitioning.
It's kind of crucial in understanding sugar cane.
Right.
So if it's a sugar storer, anything that causes growth to slow before photosynthesis, and growth is very temperature sensitive, it's going to stop growing about 18 degrees C.
Mm-hmm.
But photosynthesis is a lot less, so it will keep going at a much lower in temperature.
Right. And the higher fiber types, since they have more of that wild parentage in them, they can keep accumulating they can keep growing down to cooler temperatures. Right.
I have a question regarding the type 2 seems to be looking at additional fiber, trying to create plants or develop plants with more fiber or cholesterol and stuff.
Right.
Which do you think might yield more total ethanol per acre? And then how does that fit into harvest strategy? Do you envision a similar harvest to like a sugar cane where you have to squeeze the juice out, or are you envisioning a process with these type 2 that you just cut the whole plant off and do into this combined process?
Okay, the question was about harvest strategies as far as type 1s and type 2s. A slide I didn't include because I just for time, I actually calculated an ethanol yield based on the yield data and the preliminary ethanol data. And the top one actually was one of the type 2 canes that was kind of in the middle. There's various things that we can try as far as with the dealing with the free sugar, because it seemed our first run with the partial saccharification, we actually did a diluted acid pretreatment, and we got all kinds of inhibitors. It appeared we didn't get any good fermentation. So it may be, especially with the high sugar types, it may be more practical to squeeze that juice off and run that into a separate fermentation stream, and then take the fiber and do that separately.
We have time for one more question.
I guess just quickly, you gave your yields in grams per liter. Did you run the glucosamine when you put into fermentation? Did you calculate that back? I guess the bottom line, did you calculate that for gram per gram?
Yeah, I did.
Okay.
How did rank out?
Pardon? One of the top yielder was one of the type 2s, and then the next one, I believe, was the that intermediate one that seems to behave more like a type 1 at our location.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.